Thanks. Okay, so here's the outline about what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to start off with an overview of the various astrophysical uncertainties, what both observations and simulations can tell us. And then I'm going to talk very briefly about the consequences of those uncertainties before moving on to strategies for handling them, two different approaches, either integrating out the uncertainties or marginalising over them. And then finally, I'm going to focus on, in the second approach, the best way of parameterising the speed distribution. So first, a very brief introduction, as I'm sure this is very familiar to most of you here. So here I've written down the differential event rate for elastic scattering in the simplest possible case, assuming spin-independent coupling and equal couplings to the proton and the neutron. And what you see is the astrophysics and the particle physics are inextricably tangled up in each other. I've coloured in green the particle physics parameters, the Wundt mass and cross-section on the nucleon, and then the astrophysical input in red, the local density rho zero, and the speed distribution. And so it's been realised for a very long time that anything you try and deduce about the particle physics properties of the WIMP are going to be affected by astrophysical uncertainties on the density and speed distribution. And then one final thing to point out at this point is that actually the differential event rate is proportional to this integral over the speed distribution, starting from kinematically the minimum speed that can cause a recall of energy E, which depends both on the target mass and the WIMP mass. So one thing which will be useful later on is to look at the speed integral, which is basically just this integral over the speed distribution as a function of the minimum speed. And then simply the differential event rate is proportional to that speed integral, although there is actually another energy independent term coming in from the form factor here. So what experiments measure isn't directly the WIMP mass across section, it's events with energies. And so to go from those events and their energies to constraints on measurements of the WIMP mass and cross-section, you've got to make some assumptions. And as far as the astrophysics goes, the usual assumption is something called the standard halo model. And it basically assumes that the Milky Way halo is an isotropic isothermal sphere, in which case you have this Maxwell-Boltzmann speed distribution where the dispersion is related to the circular speed with which a circular orbit is going around the center of the Milky Way. And there are some canonical parameters get used, a circular speed of 220 and a local density of 0.3 GV per cubic centimeter. So one other thing to expand on at this point, in this very simple model, then very roughly, the speed integral comes out to be this thing here, an exponential with a characteristic energy scale. And that characteristic energy scale depends on both the WIMP mass, the target mass, and the circular speed. And if the WIMP mass is very much less than the target mass, it's proportional to the WIMP mass squared. And the other limit where the WIMP is very heavy, this is approximately constant. So what that's telling you is provided the WIMP isn't heavy compared with the target, then you can deduce the WIMP mass. You could also, because this depends on both the WIMP mass and the target nuclei mass, you can use different targets and check consistency of what you're seeing. But how well you can measure the WIMP mass is limited by how well you know the circular speed, or more precisely, the velocity dispersion of the WIMPs. And again, that's just simply coming from the fact that you're measuring energies, and the energy depends on both the mass and the velocity. Okay, so starting with the astrophysical uncertainties and what we can know from an observational point of view. This is a very busy slide, but you can kind of just concentrate on the big bits in blue. And starting with the local density. Now, the main thing is that observations just don't measure that directly. You have to do some modelling. So the general approach is to take various data sets, for instance, the rotation curve, velocity dispersions of halo stars, measurements of the mass, surface mass density, and then use them to constrain a model for the Milky Way. And that's including the luminous components and also some model for the density profile of the halo. And if you pick a particular density profile, you can get quite a high precision determination, something with order 10% errors. However, as you can already spot, I've shown you two determinations here that they've both got small errors, the actual values are somewhat different. However, if you then consider a larger range of density profiles for your halo, you end up with a somewhat larger range of densities. People have looked at model-independent methods for trying to measure the local density without having to assume particular density profiles. And again, when you do this, what you find is that your errors get much larger. And then a final point that's relevant, what these measurements are actually measuring is effectively the spherically averaged local density. And that's different from the quantity we're interested in. We're interested in the local density right here in the substellar disk. There's been some work showing that if you look in simulated halos in the disk, density is about 20% larger on average than what you get from these shell averages. I've been doing some work with Mattia for NASA in Nottingham, which we're sort of trying to look into this. And well, what we've found so far is what you get out is strongly dependent on what you put in, both in terms of data and in modeling. So I think the summary here is, whilst it is possible to have determinations of the local density with very small 10% statistical errors, there really are much bigger systematic errors in the modelling. So there are still substantial uncertainties in the local density. So coming on to the local circular speed, which is related to the velocity dispersion, the historical value goes back to a very old IAU value from a Curran Linden Bell compilation of measurements, 220 plus or minus 20 kilometres a second. There has been some suggestion from looking at the proper motion of Sagittarius A star and from using MESAR data that VC could be significantly bigger. There was then some work showing that actually, with only a handful of MESARs, their non-random phases are an issue. And actually, once you take that into account on their own, they don't tell you too much about the circular speed. And these guys, assuming a flat rotation curve, came up with this measurement of the circular speed. If you drop the assumption of a flat rotation curve, then again, you end up with a much wider range of values. Something potentially interesting in the last few months, though, is some work by Bobby et al., where they've determined separately both circular speed and the phi component of the sun's motion with respect to the galactic centre. And interestingly, what they find is a circular speed that's roughly at the 220 mark, but the phi component of the sun's motion is much bigger, about 242, sort of consistent with what people were finding for Sagittarius A star. And what you would naively expect is this phi component of the sun's motion should just be the circular speed plus the sun's motion with respect to the local standard of rest. But it isn't, it's much bigger. So there's one of two things going on here. Either the motion with respect to the local standard of rest is bigger than people thought, or the local standard of rest isn't on a circular orbit. So that's kind of interesting, and it's maybe showing that actually there wasn't a conflict between the high value of VC from Sagittarius A star and the sort of traditional 220. But the bottom line here is that once more, the systematic uncertainties are much larger than the statistical uncertainties. And then the final thing to emphasize is that whilst in the standard halo model, there's a simple one-to-one relationship between the circular speed and the velocity dispersion, that's not true in general. In general, that relationship depends on the velocity and isotropy beta. So final thing from an observational point of view, the escape speed. This gives us the maximum speed of WIMPs in the galactic rest frame. This was traditionally taken to be 650 kilometers a second. More recent work has found a range of values between about just under 500 and just over 600, with a peak at like about 550. So observations are kind of telling us about sort of the bulk properties of density and the velocity dispersion, but what we'd really like to know about is the speed distribution. And this is something that simulations can shed some insight on. So there are various people who have looked at this over the last few years using different simulations of Milky Way-like halos. And the general conclusion is that there are systematic deviations from a simple multivariate Gaussian. You typically get more low-speed particles, the peak of the distribution is a bit lower and flatter, and then you get some features which have been dubbed debris flow out in the tail of the distribution, which are arising from material that's been accreted more recently and isn't yet phase mixed. A couple of other things to mention here, we've got the distributions in the halo rest frame and in the Earth rest frame, and one thing you see is that some of these deviations and features are smeared out when you move to the Earth's rest frame due to the Earth's motion having to get averaged over. Whilst I'm on the topic of features, one thing there's been a lot of back and forth about over the years is the Sagittarius stream. The Sagittarius dwarf is getting disrupted. Question is, do we expect dark matter streams passing through the solar neighborhood? So for a while, the thought was no, because the stellar streams don't come through the solar neighborhood. However, there's been some recent work which seems to show that the dark matter streams are much more extended. So there is now still the possibility that the dark matter from the Sagittarius stream could be coming through the solar neighbourhood. There's been various people who have looked at how best to fit these speed distributions, looking at various perspectives, maybe starting, for instance, with double parallel density distribution using the Eddington formalism, which relates the density and velocity, and coming up with this thing here that does a better job of fitting the high-speed tails of the distributions in simulations. There's also been some work, which I think we'll hear about later in the week, coming up with an empirical parameterization that better fits simulations than previous things. This plot here shows in this panel the speed distribution, and here in the main panel v squared times the speed distribution, and various functions that people have used to fit the data. And what you see is it's difficult to come up with something that fits both the bulk of the distribution and does a good job in the tail. So a couple of caveats. So the first one is that the scales that the experiments probe are absolutely tiny. The sun moves a fraction of a milliparsec a year. So that's the relevant scale that we're interested in the dark matter distribution. Whereas the resolution of even the best simulations is many, many orders of magnitude better. Another way of putting it is the smallest dark matter subhalos that the simulations resolve are many orders of magnitude larger than the first smallest WIMP microhalos to form. So there's some extrapolating going on. Are the results that simulations see, which are averaged over a sort of effectively hundreds of parsecs, directly applicable to these sub-milliparsec scales? So something that worried me a lot for many years was the question of, was there fine structure in the local dark matter distribution on these tiny scales? Is it nice and smooth, or does it have lots of features? So there's been a couple of people looking into this, in particular Vogelsberger and White, came up with a really cunning technique for trying to probing the fine-grained phase space distribution within a numerical simulation. And what that allowed them to do was to measure how the density within streams fell off with time. And it falls off very steeply in a triaxial halo. And from this stream density variation, they then deduced that the ultra-local dark matter distribution should contain a huge number of streams, 10 to the 12, 10 to the 15. I think that there's a little bit of circularity going on in this argument because it does assume that the local density has the standard value of 0.3. However, having said that, though, I think this is fairly convincing that we do expect the local ultra-local dark matter distribution to be fairly smooth and not be some sort of Swiss cheese full of holes. Different approach to the same sort of problem by these guys. They actually looked at the evolution of the first smallest microhalos to form, taking into account tidal disruption and also heating from encounters with stars. And they came up with a smaller number for the number of streams in the solar neighborhood, but still pretty damn large, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 4. So again, that would lead you to the same conclusion that the ultra-local WIMP distribution should be fairly smooth, maybe some features, but nothing too awful. The other bigger caveat is baryons. Almost everything I've told you about so far has come from simulations which are dark matter only, whereas, of course, the real Milky Way has lots and lots of baryons in it. So again, this is something I believe we'll be hearing more about later in the week. There's been some work by Justin Reed and collaborators on something called a dark disk. And so the general idea here is, at fairly late times, once you've got the disk formed, subhalos that fall in later get pulled into this disk and then get destroyed in the disk, leading to the formation of a dark co-rotating disk. This could have a significant effect on the local speed distribution and consequently on the WIMP signals, although how significant really depends on its density and velocity dispersion. So here I've plotted the standard halo model in black and then a couple of sort of really toy models for a dark disk, one with a very high density and a low velocity dispersion, lower density and high velocity dispersion, and then lower density and high velocity dispersion. And so for it to be significant, you need both a high density and a small velocity dispersion. However, the properties of the dark disk are very uncertain. We could well be in this situation here where it has a relatively small effect. And in particular, there's been some work showing that actually the merger history of the Milky Way has to be fairly quiet. To get a really big dark disk, you need lots of big recent mergers. And if that happened, then actually the disk wouldn't look like it does, the visible stellar disk. And also from an observational point of view, there's not a huge amount of room for a very high dark density disk in terms of what you actually see. So that's something which could be there, but whether it's significant or not is another question. So consequences of the things I've been talking about. So going back to the beginning and the local density. So the normalization, the differential event rate, depends on the product of the cross-section and the density. So therefore, the uncertainties in the density translate directly into uncertainties in the local cross, in the cross-section. When comparing experiments, that's not so important because they all shift up and down in the same way, but it is important if you then want to constrain the cross-section. And another point, the point out by Scari and Trotter, is that actually, as well as that effect on the density, you also end up with a bias in your determination of the wind mass. Okay, next, the circular speed. And what I'm going to say here is focusing on the circular speed in the context of the standard halo model. So again, this means that you're sort of, it's an uncertainty in the velocity dispersion of the particles. So it shifts the exclusion limits. There's something that people often say is, well, it shifts everything in the same way, so you don't need to worry. That's not true. The shift is different for different experiments. However, in terms of exclusion limits, it's a relatively small effect, except possibly for light winds. Where this would be significant in the future is if you had a positive signal and you were trying to determine the wind mass from it. So if you remember, this is being done from this characteristic energy effectively, and you can see just by differentiating this equation that the uncertainty in the circular speed translates directly into an uncertainty in the wind mass. And so sort of more sort of concretely, if the circular speed is higher than you think it is, then the velocity dispersion is higher, and hence you'll think that the WIMPs are more massive than they actually are. Moving on to the shape of the velocity distribution. So, as we've already seen, the differential event rate is proportional to an integral over the speed distribution. So that effectively smooths out a lot of the features in the speed distribution. And it means that exclusion limits are relatively insensitive to the exact shape for the velocity distribution. And so again, what we're seeing in this plot here is that the shapes of exclusion limits are changing in different ways for different experiments, but not hugely. Similarly, if you have a look at what sort of effect you find if future determinations of the wind mass, and you end up with this roughly 2 to 5% uncertainty. So not a huge deal. That, however, is probably largely only true for experiments which probe the bulk of the velocity distribution. If your experiment probes only the tail of the density distribution, the velocity distribution, then the exact shape is going to be far more important. So, and this is particularly applicable to these possible hints of light WIMPs that experiments are seeing at the moment. And in particular, what I've shown here is the ratio of the speed integrals for two different models, a Maxwellian with a very high cutoff and one of the parameterizations I showed you earlier with a low cutoff. And for high Vmin, you get significant differences. And the other thing I'd like to emphasize here is that actually once you get into the region where you're dealing with just the tail of the distribution, it's really important to average over the Earth's orbit. If you don't do that, again, that can give you significant errors in what you're finding. And then, as I've already mentioned, the dark disk, that could clearly have a very significant effect on mass determinations and also an annual modulation signal if the density is very high and the velocity distribution velocity dispersion is quite low. So finally, to wrap up the implications, I've talked mainly about exclusion limits and mass measurements which come from just measuring the differential event rates. There are some other potential signals that arise due to our mass with respect to the galactic rest frame. The Sun is moving in the direction of a constellation called Cygnus, and the Earth is orbiting the Sun. So the detector rest speed varies annually with respect to galactic rest frame, and this leads to an annual modulation in the event rate. Now, it turns out that this is very sensitive to the detailed shape of the speed distribution, and you can sort of see the reason from this plot here. I've plotted the standard halo model, the speed distribution, the detector rest frame in summer in black, and in winter the dotted line, and this is coming from a really small shift, so it's not hard to see that by changing the shape of the distribution, the annual modulation, both its phase and amplitude, can change quite significantly. And then finally, if you had a detector that could measure not just the energies of the events, but their directions, you then end up with a very powerful directional signal. You get a sort of peak in the direction opposite to the direction of solar motion. The rear front asymmetry in the directional signal is pretty damn robust, whatever you might want to plausibly do to the speed distribution. However, the peak recall this direction could vary, in particular with high-speed WIMPs coming in from different directions. So in these two cases, the uncertainties in the speed distribution are far more important than they were for just probing the differential event rate. So now we come to how do we deal with all of this? And so the first strategy is what's been termed integrating out the astrophysical uncertainties. And I'll only talk about this very briefly because we'll be hearing a lot more about it later in the week. So as I've already said, the differential event rate is proportional to the speed integral GV min. And so what this basically involves is comparing experiments in this space in terms of GV min. The subtlety here, though, is that V min depends on both the energies and the unknown WIMP mass. So this isn't something you can do once and for all. You have to do it for every potential WIMP mass you might be interested in. This approach has been a lot of interest in it. People have extended it to take into account experimental issues like energy resolution and efficiency. It's also been extended to take into account annual modulation signals. And this is a really powerful way of checking the consistency of signals and exclusion limits. And so it's been employed looking at the current situation where we've got these various hints and signals that perhaps are indicative of light WIMPs. And so I'm just showing very briefly here a comparison from these guys here. Three different WIMP masses. And so what you're seeing is in this GV min versus V min plane, you've got exclusion limits as lines and data points. So that's annual modulations as the data points. And bottom line is that this shows that however wild and wacky a velocity distribution you might want to cook up, it's not possible to reconcile the exclusion limits with the annual modulation signals that Cogent and Dama are seeing. So this is a really good way of assessing whether different things are compatible, but in general, better, because this is essentially assuming that we know nothing about the local speed distribution. And in fact, we're not in that situation. We do think we know something about it. So another approach to take is to parameterize your speed distribution and then marginalize over the parameters of the speed distribution. And there have been various approaches to this by a long list of people taking different possible forms for the speed distribution, possibly different models of the Milky Way, and sometimes throwing in some astrophysical data to get additional constraints. If the underlying shape of the speed distribution is similar to the shape of your parameterization, this works really well. So this is an example of some work by Annika Peter, simulating the data you might expect from future ton-scale experiments using xenon, argon, and germanium. The top row is with a standard halo model in, analyze it assuming the standard halo model, but allow the lag speed and the RMS speed to vary. And we've got results here for 50, 100, and 500 GeV masses. And as you can see, that in this case where you're standard model in, analyze it assuming the standard halo model, things work pretty nicely. However, if, for instance, you had a model which was a standard halo model plus a dark disk, then what you'd get out is not a good match to what went in. And in particular, you're getting these significant biases in both the mass and the cross-section. So you need to think about parameterizing the speed distribution. And so something to emphasize here is that if you've only got a single experiment, you can't say anything about the WIMP mass without making some assumptions about the form of the speed distribution. And this is just this degeneracy between masses and speeds when you come to measured energies. However, if you've got more than one experiment, you can break this degeneracy, and you don't have to make restrictive assumptions about the speed distribution. And so this led Annika to suggest the idea of, instead of using a specific shape for the speed distribution, to use an empirical parameterization and then constrain the parameters of that parameterization along the mass and cross-section. So it's the first sort of approach, you know, just to show that you can do this, she looked at taking the speed distribution and parameterizing it as being constant in bins. And so again, here's what you're getting out for the mass and effectively the cross-section using this parameterization, and for the problematic case of the standard halo model with a dark disk. And you do much, much better than you did than when you assumed the completely wrong standard halo model, but you're still getting some bias in both the mass and the cross-section. And in particular for the cross-section, the problem's coming from the fact that experiments have finite resolution and can't probe the lowest speed bin. So with Bradley Kavanagh, a PhD student in Nottingham, we've been trying to think of ways as how you can do better at parameterizing the speed distribution. And the first thing we realized was where the issue with the mass bias was coming from here. And what was happening is you can do a better job of fitting things the more bins of your parameterization that are being probed. And so what was happening was the mass was artificially being pushed low in order to populate more bins. So this was the first issue we needed to do something about. And so the first solution we tried was instead of parameterizing the speed distribution in constant bins, we parameterized the reduced nucleus momentum distribution. And the reason why that turned out to be a good thing to do is because the minimum accessible momentum for each experiment is independent of the WIMP mass, whereas the minimum accessible speed depended on the unknown WIMP mass. So by doing that, we were taking out this issue of your speed parameterization getting shifted around. So we did this, and what we found is that the biases were reduced and the statistical coverage was better. And by statistical coverage, this is wanting that your 68 and 95% confidence limits really do encompass the right value of the mass 68 to 95% of the time. So we did this for masses of 50 and 100 GeV for three different models, standard halo model, standard halo model and dark disk, and using speed distribution from Via Lactea 2. You do see, though, even for the 50 GeV case, a tail of high mass determinations. We weren't sure whether that was an issue with the method or something that's been termed bad reconstructions when, due to Poisson stats, you just simply get a set of events where you've got more high energy events than you expect. So this was doing a lot better than speed parameterization, but we were still finding a bias in the WIMP mass, in particular for extreme models with a dark disk. And the problem there was that the speed distribution is varying quite rapidly over a small range of speeds, and we just weren't picking this up very well with the constant bins. So what Bradley realized is what you wanted to do was come up with something where there were no binning, no fixed scales. And so what we found works really rather well is to parameterize the speed distribution in terms of shifted Legendre polynomials. Since I'm running short on time, I'll skip the reasons why that's a sensible thing to do and show you these results. So we did a reconstruction. Here's the input WIMP mass and cross-section, blue standard halo model, green standard halo model and dark disk, red for a really extreme case of one stream dominating the speed distribution. And here are our reconstructions of the speed distribution, standard halo model and dark disk and stream. So it's doing well at reconstructing mass and also the speed distribution. There is an inevitable problem that you end up underestimating the cross-section, and that's simply because you're not probing the speed distribution below the V-min of threshold of the lowest experiment. So at the moment, we're looking at some ways of possibly looking into solving that problem, but in general, this seems to work pretty well. So to wrap all of that up, going right the way back to the beginning, the direct detection energy spectrum depends on astrophysical quantities, namely local matter density and velocity distribution. In particular, the local dark matter density affects the normalization and hence the cross-section. The velocity dispersion affects how well you can determine the mass. And the detailed shape of the velocity distribution can be important if you're interested in light WIMPs that only probe the tail of the distribution, or if you're measuring an annual modulation signal. We looked at how astronomical observations can constrain parameters, in particular the local density and the circular speed. And whilst these things are quite small, the systematic errors from uncertainties in the modeling are still much larger. There are various ways of dealing with these. I mentioned very briefly integrating out the astrophysics, which is great if you want to sort of compare whether different signals are compatible or not. If you actually want to try and learn something about the WIMP mass and cross-section, possibly a better approach is to parameterize the speed distribution. And I've talked about various ways of doing this and how you can try and adapt your parameterization so that you get unbiased measurements of the mass and cross section, and also probe the speed distribution too. So that's it, thanks.
Questions for Anne?
So I'm curious about the dark disk models everybody's having a hard time fitting. As a co-author on that Reed paper, I can tell you that those simulations were not nearly as good as they are today, right? They tend to suffer from overcooling. There's a lot of probably adiabatic contraction. And their mass in the disk is probably overestimated. And I know that Mike Coolin last week was also showing work from Aris, showing that when you have these more realistic runs, the mass in the dark disk is not nearly as high. So I'm curious if, you know, if that's the case, are these models that everybody's trying to match based on like the original read at all, and could they be actually overestimating the amount of mass?
So to be honest, these things we put in here are really quite extreme dark disks. So corresponding to the thing which probably nobody now believes anymore, as in sort of this case here. I think from the point of view of trying to handle the speed parameterization, it's actually a good idea to consider extreme things, so then you've got something that works. But to be honest, my guess is, from what you've said and what Mike said last week, we're probably closer to this case here. And once you integrate over that, that's not such a big deal.
And I don't know if you thought about this, but it's not like, you know, in a few months there's going to be a new space probe, Gaia, that will measure 10% of all the stars that are in the Milky Way. So presumably that will reduce some of these uncertainties. Have you thought about this and exactly what you would like Gaia to do?
Huh? It's on the to-do list.
It's on the to-do list. But any ideas particularly about these dark disks? Because you only see stars, not the dark disk. What can Gaia do for that?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. Maybe somebody else here has a better idea.
Okay. So I think what you would really want is to have a whole bunch of different stellar populations that you could look at the Z motions for and essentially have some non-parametric model or something like that. For how the density falls off in Z, and then try to map it with the different stellar populations. So, I mean, I think that's because the thing is, like, the dark disk, the density fall off would be a little bit different than if you had, you know, a standard halo. So you still, I think it's still, you know, my guess is that we all probably quite likely have a small-ish dark disk, so that makes figuring this out difficult, but, I mean, I think, in principle, I think there are tools in place to deal with it.
I guess in terms of those parameters, Gaia, the most it can do is to reduce the uncertainty of row zero, but it can't tell you much on FOV, so probably won't gain that much for V, but probably just a little bit for row, or just to raise a little bit, something on row.
Especially in terms of dark disk, I think in the most realistic cases, this doesn't contribute much to rho. I mean, the mass in the dark disk.
It's more the speed distribution. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, even using vertical motions, I'm afraid it's going to be quite difficult actually to measure that.
Anything else?
I'm sorry. Maybe you said it, but dark disk versus that we happen to be within some stream, which is more likely to play a larger effect?
I suppose it depends on what you're interested in. So in terms of streams, people have looked in simulations, and whilst there are lots of streams, the probability of there being a high density stream this close in seems to be quite small in simulations. However, there is the thing that the Sagittarius stream might well come through the solar neighborhood. But the dark disk and the streams affect distribution in very different ways. The streams are a feature at high speed, and are hence more likely to be accessible, whereas the dark disk is down at low speed and gets integrated over. So you've got to weigh the probability of these things being astrophysically relevant, and then they affect the signals in different ways.
Maybe this isn't so relevant for you, I don't know, but maybe you or someone else here has an opinion. So you've been talking about direct detection. What about for indirect detection? What are the uncertainties in J or in the integral of rho squared?
Well, there's lots of people here far better qualified to talk about this than I am.
So I don't know in what kind of detail you want to discuss the issue, but if you're looking towards the galactic center, for instance, so we know from numerical simulations more with dark matter only, they tell us more or less what the value of J should be within a factor of a few, I would say. The problem is when you start to put variance in these numerical simulations, things may change substantially. And I guess in so we heard about the ARIS simulation in one of the previous comments, and I think you have an announcement of the dark matter density towards the center. So, you know, even a factor of 10 would not be extreme if you just wanted to attach an uncertainty on the value of J towards the galactic center.
To Peter's question, actually, so you give a comment about this. This already assumed that the dark matter is collisionless. So in my talk, I will show that if you add dark matter self-interactions, you will change the story a lot, actually.
So the J factor is a function. So the J factor is actually a function of
Just following up on what you said and what Allison said, I mean, I think that none of these simulations are really forming, you know, galaxies robustly, and there's still essentially significant uncertainty, right? I mean, what's that? You disagree? Well, I mean, I don't think we've conclusively formed the range of galaxies that could be our Milky Way so that we really can say what the J factor is. That's my only point. And we should discuss.
Discuss, yes. Yeah. I just have one small thing to contribute to this. I totally agree that who knows what J is. However, I think you have to be very wary when you take one simulation of a galaxy in isolation, and you don't know if you simulate a freak of nature or what it is. So by no means they're representative. Even the Aquarius halos that are featured there, actually, as it happens, in Fogelsberg et al., we only managed to do 6, and as it happens, they weren't necessarily very representative. So you have to be worried about that. But the good news, though, is that their efforts now, which are require a huge amount of work to try and address that problem. So it's 2 projects where a population of galaxies, more than just 1 or 2, is being simulated. One led by Volker Springel and Lars Henquist and colleagues, and the other one that we are doing in my place and with the Virgo Consortium, and these 2 have large populations of galaxies that form and meet some minimum requirements, like, for example, that they should give the right number of galaxies of different luminosities, for instance, they shouldn't produce too many stars and so on. And one thing I can tell you, the preliminary result, is that the effects of variance are grossly exaggerated. And in fact, I use for, it's not surprising because star formation regulates itself. And so what happens is that in the end, they don't do much in terms of enhancing or diluting the density of dark matter. So that is very provisional, and it's good that two competing efforts, because we'll be able to compare notes, but that's what we're getting so far. So, but again, but I think you shouldn't really put this in the bank and bet your house on it, but at least there's progress in this area.
Just a comment on the area stipulation, which is the best one to date of the Milky Way, and does give a remarkable fits to everything for the current Milky Way, although you can debate what it does in the past. So it predicts, we heard last week, that there is, at its resolution, there is no dark substructure whatsoever surviving in the inner galaxy. So that's something to bear in mind. It's all destroyed, and that's due to various tidal, et cetera, interactions. Of course, what goes on at higher resolution, we don't know, but that's down to, say, 100,000 solar masses or less.
Well, I had another quick question, actually, about the fits that you were showing.
Yeah.
How do they work if there's, let's say, some anisotropy to the halo? Have you tried different parameterizations?
We haven't yet looked at that. This is very much work in progress. My guess is it probably doesn't have a huge effect, because even, I mean, you're thinking sort of anisotropics, velocity distribution. Yeah. Once you then boil it down to the speed distribution, I suppose it could, I don't know, is actually, we should look at it.
Okay. Are there any more questions?
Nope.
Okay, if not, let's thank Anne one more time. And there's a coffee break now, and I guess we'll reconvene in a half hour at 11 o'clock.